start off today with a story. An elderly gentleman was growing old and feeble. His family thought him a little bit eccentric because some of his habits, some of the things that he collected. In particular, there was one box that really intrigued them. Yet he never opened it in their presence. And when he was by himself, he would open it and he would very carefully examine its contents, and then just as carefully he would put everything back and he would hide the box away so that it was securely hidden. The family had looked for it when he wasn't around, but to no avail. They wanted to know what was inside. And as he became more frail and his health began to deteriorate even more, the family began to speculate as to the contents of the box. And, you know, which one of them might inherit that prized box upon his death. One of them thought it was some very valuable stocks. Another was sure it was just a collection of jewels and gold. Others thought it was deeds to property that had become very valuable over time. They were all sure it was very valuable because, you know, the way that he looked after it, the way that he protected it. Time went on, sadly. They began to even look forward to his death so that they could see what was in the box. They'd get their hands on that box. And when the elderly gentleman died, they finally got their wish to see the contents of the box, all the secrets that it contained. Look, I've got a box today. I'll set that box right there. I'm sure you can't see it very well. And it is my box. I've had this box in my possession for over 50 years now. But I can tell you with certainty that it's quite a bit older than that. See, it belonged to my dad when he was a little boy. And you can see all the ornate, I mean, he's the one that painted everything, his initials are even painted on the top of it there. He had it when he was a little boy. And I don't know if it had a history before that. But this box could easily be 80 years old at this point in time, if not older. He'd used it to hold valuable objects from his boyhood. And he passed it to me, and I did the very same thing. I've put things in this box that were important to me as I was growing up, and I've continued to add contents to it over the years. Wouldn't you like to know what's in my box? Is it important? Is it valuable? Now, I've got you a little bit curious, probably, right? What is in my box? We'll just leave that there for now. Have you ever looked at something that God did or that God made, and you wonder to yourself, you know, why did he do it that way? It doesn't make much sense. And there are times when it seems that God does something for no apparent reason at all. You know, if we were in charge, we would have certainly done it differently. We would not have done it that way. And we can often think, you know, there has to be a better way to do that. I'll give you an example. Why did God create Adam and Eve on this planet when he knew that Satan was here? You ever wondered about that? I mean, God had to know that the odds were really, really good that Satan would cause Adam and Eve to turn against him. He had to know that that was definitely a possibility. So why didn't he create them somewhere else? Could have put a planet anywhere. Started Adam and Eve there. Or why didn't he banish Satan to somewhere else? See, there had to be a better way, a way that would have allowed mankind to be successful right away. Why did God do that? But, you know, as we study, as we learn, as we strive in our efforts to become like our elder brother Jesus Christ, we come to understand God really does know what he's doing. We come to understand that God's way is indeed the best way. And many times we miss out on important things, we miss out on important principles, because we fail to miss the significance of that, Do we ever ask, as we're reading through things, wait, God put that in there. What is the significance of that? See, when God stops, when he gives very specific instructions on anything, you have to realize he had a reason for doing that. Let me give you another example. Let's consider the building of the Old Testament tabernacle. All the things that went into that tabernacle. God was very specific about how it was to be made, what it was to be made of, the exact dimensions, things like that. And he had a reason. And in the New Testament, we do come to understand that that old temple was a forerunner of the things in the heavenly temple. Therefore, when we see detailed instructions for not only the tabernacle, but also for the items in the tabernacle, we have to stop and realize these things are important. I mean, they're important enough that God put the detail into it. Shouldn't those things be important to us as well? I want to focus today on the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant, that was probably the most important part of the tabernacle in the first temple. It represented the presence of God in the nation, among the nation. So let's start out with a description of it here. Exodus 25, let's start out there today. Exodus 25, verses 10 through 21. Again, as we go through here, God is very specific on things. And how often we just read right through this. You know, just words kind of thing. Let's begin in verse 10. It says, they shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width, 1.5 cubits its height. You shall overlay it with pure gold, inside and out you shall overlay it, shall make on it a molding of gold all around. He shall cast 4 rings of gold for it, put them in its 4 corners. 2 rings shall be on one side, 2 rings on the other side. He shall make poles of acacia wood, overlay them with gold. And he shall put the poles into the rings on the side of the ark, that the ark may be carried by them. And the poles shall be in the rings of the ark, and he shall not be taken from it. And you shall put into the ark the testimony which I will give you. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold, of hammered work you shall make them, at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub at one end, the other cherub at the other end. You shall make the cherub at the 2 ends of it of 1 piece with the mercy seat. And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above, covering the mercy seat. With their wings they shall face one another. Faces of the cherubim shall be toward the mercy seat. And you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. So this describes the ark and the mercy seat. Although we're given the measurement for the box, for the, you know, the ark itself, we still don't know the exact dimensions. We're told in cubits that the problem is we don't know how long a cubit was. Different times you had different lengths of cubit. For example, if it was an 18-inch cubit, the ark would have been roughly 45 inches long by 27 inches wide by 27 inches tall. Now, you do some reading, the Egyptian cubit at that time was roughly 21 inches, maybe a little bit more than 21 inches. And if that's the case, then the ark would have been 53 inches long by 33 inches tall. So we really don't know, but it's in the neighborhood of 4 feet long by 2.5 feet wide in dimension and 2.5 feet tall before you put the lid on it, the mercy seat. Now the mercy seat that sat above the Ark of the Covenant symbolized God's throne among his people. That tabernacle was the center of worship for the children of Israel. God showed his presence among his people at the Holy of Holies, where the tabernacle was to reside. And if there was a fire over the tabernacle at night, or if there was a cloud that hung over it during the day, they knew God's presence was there in the Holy of Holies. It's a very visible thing. And we see that God gave specific directions on the building of the ark, as well as the mercy seat. He gave exact dimensions. He gave the materials that would be used in making it. But notice in this section that we read twice, he mentioned that his testimony that he would give them was to reside in the ark. So he's very particular regarding everything that was used in worshiping him. He left nothing to chance to be guessed at. And he even gave the specific direction on how the ark was to be transported, how it was to be carried. Suspended from two long poles, had eyelets on each side. It was to be moved by his servants, the Levites. Let's go now to 1 Samuel, the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 4. 1 Samuel 4, I want to read verses 6 through 11. Things didn't always go well with the ark. This is talking about a time when Israel was fighting the Philistines here. We're going to kind of break into the story. We can pick it up in verse 5 here. 1 Samuel 4, verse 5. And when the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Now when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And they understood the ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid, and they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us, who will deliver us from the hand of their mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptian and all the plagues of the wilderness. Be strong. Conduct yourselves as men, you Philistines, that you may not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. And every man fled to his tent, and there was a great slaughter. And there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. And then notice verse 11. Also, the ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So we see the Philistines have now captured the ark of God, in this battle with Israel. So they're very proud of themselves, and they take the ark back to their nation. Notice verse 22. It said, and she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." So that's pretty significant, isn't it? It says God's glory had now departed from Israel because the ark was no longer there. Let's go to chapter 5 now, verse 11 and 12. So the Philistines now have the ark, but things aren't going well with them either. Verse 11 says, so they sent and they gathered together all the lords of the Philistines. So they're all getting together. They said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel. Let it go back to its own place so that it does not kill us and our people. For there was a deadly destruction throughout all the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were stricken with the tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven." So God cursed the Philistines. And he brings a severe plague on the entire nation until they were to send the ark back. It's a period of about 7 months. Go to chapter 7, verses 1 and 2. Chapter 7, verse 1 and 2. It says, then the men of Kirjath-Jearim came, and they took the ark of the Lord, and they brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. So, they're sending the ark back. But now it's at a private residence. And you look at it, and that private residence housed the ark of God for some 20 years. You know, they didn't feel enough to be able to go and to bring it back. So it sat there, this private residence, for a long time. Let's go to 2 Samuel now. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 1 through 5. And they're finally deciding now to bring the ark back to Jerusalem. This is with David. 2 Samuel 6, beginning in verse 1. Again, David gathered all the choice men of Israel, 30,000. That's a lot of people. And David arose, he went with all the people who were with him from Baal, Judah, to bring up from there the ark of God, whose name is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. So they set the ark of God on a new cart, and they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, drove the new cart. And they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, accompanying the ark of God, and Ahio went before the ark. And then David and all the house of Israel played music before the Lord on all kinds of instruments, of fir wood, on harps, of stringed instruments, tambourines, sistrums, and on cymbals. David, 30,000 people. This is an occasion. There's a lot of people, and they're celebrating, and they're dancing, and they're playing music. But in spite of their intention, in spite of their desire to bring the ark back to Jerusalem, God knows right here, they still don't have the proper respect for that ark, for what it represents. And he teaches them a valuable lesson. We notice that in verse 7. Let's do verse 6. And when they came to Nahon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled, so the cart is rocking back and forth. Then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him there for his error, and he died there by the ark of God. Struck him for his error. See, God was very particular. He was very concerned that the ark wasn't being brought back in the right manner. It was brought on the back of a cart. And we see this man, Uzzah, and the oxen stumble, the cart rocks back and forth, and he reaches out, as anybody would do, to stabilize the ark. That's very important. He wanted to protect it. And it says God struck him dead on the spot. And that's one of those things you can study into. Seemed like he was doing, you know, what would come natural, what seemed right, and yet he died. But we understand that God was upset because they didn't follow the specific directions on how to transport it in the manner that he had specified. They had taken that aspect of it lightly. I'm sure they chose very good oxen. It was a new cart, had 30,000 people. They're singing, they're dancing. And yet they transported it in the wrong manner. They took it lightly. They paid the cost. Now the word ark, when you look it up, it means a box, a chest, or a coffer used to keep valuable things sure and safe. Look at the ark that Noah built. Kept his family, his kids, their family, all the animals sure and safe from the flood. And then we can look at the Ark now of the Covenant. It was a box. It was used to keep certain things sure and safe. And we read in Exodus 25 where it said not once but twice that God's testimony was to be placed in the Ark. Now, that word testimony means literally something spoken again and again. And we know that what it was talking about with the testimony were the two tablets of stone on which God had written the Ten Commandments. So this ark formed the foundation, the box, if you will, formed that foundation upon which the mercy seat, which represented the very throne of God among his people, upon which it was placed. Let's go back to Hebrews 9. And in Hebrews 9, what we're going to see here is we're going to be told There were other things in the ark beside the Ten Commandments. You know, it got me to thinking, what was God's reasoning for putting these things in the ark? Was it, you know, just because he felt like it? Just by chance? What, did he want to preserve them? Why did he want to preserve these certain things? And what we probably never considered was that he did it out of love and concern for us. I mean, that would probably be the furthest thought in your mind. Again, though, we see where he doesn't do anything by chance or by accident. He doesn't do things haphazardly, negligently. With God, everything is done for a reason. So Hebrews 9 and verse 4. Hebrews 9 and verse 4. And it's talking about, you know, the holiest of all, the Holy of Holies. And within the Holy of Holies, here in verse 4, which had the golden censer and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. So we're given a glimpse inside the Holy of Holies here. And it says there's this golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant. That's where these things resided. And it was in this area that the priest only went once a year on the Day of Atonement. But notice here also we're given a list of things that were inside of the Ark. Notice them. That's golden pot of manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables or the tablets of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. Just three things. Couldn't there have been many more? Shouldn't there have been many more? Then you have to look and say, what's the significance of each one of these items? So we know God does everything for a reason. So these items must have been vital. They must have been very important in the eyes of God. And therefore, by extension, they should also be important to us. And therefore, it would help us then to look at these things. So what did the ark itself stand for? Let's look at that before we look at what was in the ark. We'll go through each one of these three items. If you remember back in Exodus 25, we're told that the Ark of the Covenant served as the base, the foundation for the mercy seat. In other words, God's throne among his people. So the box itself was that foundation. Formed that foundation then for God's greatness, for his love, for his mercy. Therefore, the things that were placed in the box would have had a lot to do with God's care, his greatness, his mercy. The items in the box, or the items in that Ark of the Covenant, were chosen because they had special meaning for Israel. And that was in their relationship with God, these three things. They each had a major impact on Israel's belief upon their relationship with the Creator. So let's do some digging. Let's find out how they impacted the beliefs, the faith of the children of Israel. So we'll begin with the manna. And from there we'll go into Aaron's rod that budded, and we'll end up with the tables of the covenant. So why was manna? Or is manna what it means? It means, what is it? So why was that, a jar of manna, placed in the Ark of the Covenant for protection, for safekeeping, as a memorial? So what was its special significance that allowed it to be placed in such a high position? Let's go back to Exodus, Exodus 16 this time, in verse 4. Exodus 16. In verse 4, this is when we're talking about the manna. Verse 4, and the Lord said to Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. God calls it here bread from heaven. Supernatural sustenance. Something that's directly from God. Something that can not be attributable to anyone else. To any other supernatural phenomenon at all. Something that is done so that there's absolutely no doubt this came from God. Verse 6. Let's drop down to verse 6. And Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, At evening you shall know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. So this was to be a sign of God's deliverance. Another sign, you might say. Showing his care, showing he was going to feed and provide for them. Drop down to verse 13 and 14. Verse 13, so it was that quail came up at evening, covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. So you have this substance, this what is it, this manna. That's unlike anything anyone had ever seen before. And it says it just appeared as the dew evaporated. There's no natural explanation for it. What it was, where it came from. We're told later it tasted like honey wafers. Quite tasty. But, you know, in addition to that, it wasn't like your breakfast cereal. It was also provided the nutrition that they all needed. Verse 15. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, What is it? That's where you get manna. For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, This is the bread which the Lord has given to you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need, one omer for a person according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those that are in his tent. Now, when I read through all of this, again, I stop. I have questions, you know, with all of this. Things for, we weren't there. So we don't know the answers to them. For example, how did you gather it? You know, if it's small and if it's fragile and it looks like frost, I mean, do you have a rake? I mean, how do you gather that? Does it stick to your hands? And as you're gathering all this, did it pick up bits of grass and rocks and sand with the manna? Did you have to sift it to get all the gunk out of it? Did every family go out to gather it for themselves? Or perhaps you had teams of people that would go out and gather and bring it to a distribution site, and then people would come and they would get their daily allotment. How does that done? 2 million people. This is not a small, you know, mom-and-pop operation. Someday it's going to be nice to see the movie, isn't it? To see how they did that. How it was done. What we do know for certain, Israel was provided for. They were given this perfect food for 40 years. 6 days a week. Every day except the Sabbath. And we notice that, verse 19. Moses said, Let no one leave any of it till morning. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses. Some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms, and it stank. And Moses was angry with them. So this, what is it? This manna is very fragile, isn't it? It would spoil if you saved it until morning. You know, and just how many things do you know, I guess milk maybe, that would smell and have worms just overnight? So in other words, they had to depend upon God to provide this substance for them daily. Now the being who would later come as Christ, remember part of that prayer that he gave to his disciples of which they're to pray? Give us this day our daily bread. The very same being. He's here teaching the children of Israel that exact same lesson, physically. This was to be a lesson in faith. And they were provided just enough for the day. There had to be a total reliance on God. There was not a chance at all that they could stop and feel self-sufficient by any means. They had to trust God. Let's go down to verse 22. So it was on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. And all the rulers of the congregation came and they told Moses. And they said to them, "This is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning." So they laid up till morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. This is another miracle, isn't it? Once a week. It would last overnight, into the next day. They were told specifically to plan for that. This points out how important the Sabbath was to God. He changed the very nature of manna, so that every Friday, for 40 years, it would last for 2 days. Verse 27, let's continue on. Happened, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but there was none found. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." And so the people rested on the seventh day. So you still have people that didn't believe the instructions. And they go out on the Sabbath. And they went hungry. There was nothing to eat. See, if they didn't believe, if they didn't depend upon God's goodness to give them twice as much on Friday, they would have gone without every Saturday. But see, God provided. Not only did he provide, they had to do their part as well. And if they didn't, there were consequences. You went hungry for that day. But as we read through here, I want you to notice something else as well. This is before the children of Israel were given the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. God was teaching them what? About his Sabbath day before the Ten Commandments were given. But notice as he states here in verse 28, he says, "How long will you refuse to obey my commands and my laws?" Think about that. It's hard to keep something if you don't know about it yet, isn't it? You know, God doesn't say, oh, it's okay, I haven't given you the rules yet. Do whatever you want for now. He didn't say that. This would indicate there was some knowledge of his commandments and his rules before Sinai, wouldn't it? Just a side point there. Verse 31. And the house of Israel called its name manna, and it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. So manna is this perfect nutritional food. And it was tasty at the same time. It wasn't like he had oatmeal every day, you know, that kind of thing. God was concerned that they had something that was not only nutritious, but tasted good as well. He was that concerned for their care for them. Verses 32 through 34 now. Moses said, "This is a thing that the Lord has commanded. Fill an omer with it to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a pot, put an omer of manna in it, lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations." And the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. They had 40 years here, we see, of God providing for them, didn't they? And so they were told here, remember what God had done for them. And as part of that remembrance, they were to take this omer, this, you know, golden pot, we're told, and to save some of it so that future generations could see it, to know that it was real, so that they would know that God took care of them. Now consider this. That omer of manna didn't rot, ever. We see also that it was to be kept with the testimony, the two tablets of the Ten Commandments. Now, consider as well, this was yet before the ark was even built. In verse 35, children of Israel ate manna 40 years until they came to the inhabited land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. 40 years God provided for them. He fed them. Now, let's look at some very interesting places and other parts of God's Word that talks about the manna, that talk about its importance as well. Psalm 78, verses 22 through 25. Psalm 78. Let's begin in verse 22. This one was written by Asaph. But in verse 22, because they did not believe in God, talking about the children of Israel, and did not trust in His salvation, yet He commanded the clouds above, He opened the doors of heaven, He rained down manna on them to eat, and given them to the bread, and given them of the bread of heaven. In verse 25, men ate angels' food, and He sent them food to the full. Notice there, they didn't trust in God's salvation. There was a certain expectation of it, that He would take care of them. But through all of this, as is said here, they ultimately didn't trust Him. So, how would He take care of that? How would He help them to trust Him? He gave them that perfect food, that food that filled all their needs on a daily basis. You know, and He did that so that they would come to depend upon Him and hopefully to trust Him. God wanted the children of Israel to remember how He cared for them, to remember that He fed them, that He took care of their every need for 40 years. Let's go now to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah 9, verse 20 and 21. Nehemiah 9, in beginning in verse 20. It says, you also gave your good spirit to instruct them, and did not withhold your manna from their mouth, and gave them water for their thirst. 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness. They lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out, and their feet did not swell. So manna was a symbol of God's care for the children of Israel. He held nothing back. He says everything they needed. They wanted, obviously, a lot more, but everything they needed, He gave to them. Everything that was necessary, everything that was beneficial for them. They lacked nothing, even their clothes. You didn't have to worry about the fashion changing, did you? It's the same fashion. Their shoes didn't wear out. They still fit. That in itself would have been another miracle. Now, it says also their feet didn't swell. But in the original Hebrew, it means that they didn't get blisters for 40 years wandering around. God's care was perfect. It was complete. Let's look at another aspect now. Deuteronomy 8 in verse 3. Deuteronomy 8 in verse 3. And it says, so he humbled you. He allowed you to hunger, and he fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you to know that man shall not live by bread alone. Man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So part of the lesson of the manna was to humble them, to realize that they couldn't take care of themselves, that they had a need for God. He wanted to teach them dependence, reliance upon him, to have that attitude that said they would always look to him for their answers. We've just come through the spring holy days. Remember part of what these holy days teach us? To examine ourselves so that we may humble ourselves. That's the lesson of the manna. Drop down to verse 16. Verse 16. Breaking into the thought, it says, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, that he might test you, to do you good in the end. So not only humbling, but also to test them. Would they respond to him? Would they express thanks? Would they rely upon him for good? All the good things that he wanted to give to them. In describing why the pot of manna was in the ark, Barnes notes states this. He says, a small quantity of manna was to be preserved as a perpetual reminder of the food they had eaten, the goodness of God in supplying their needs. As the manna would not rot quickly, and this manna was preserved, or as the manna would rot quickly, and this manna was preserved, it would be a perpetual miracle and proof of the presence and faithfulness of God. In the New Testament, we see where the manna was talked about as well. Let's go to John 6, verse 31. John 6. Verse 31. Verse 31 says, our fathers ate the manna in the desert. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. So God fed them that manna. Again, he calls it bread from heaven. Verse 32 and 33. And Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give you bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. So that this manna was to be a symbol, again, another symbol of Jesus Christ, who gives life spiritually. Verses 47 through 50. Christ again says, most assuredly, I say to you, he who believes in me has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is a bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. So he's raising it to another level, but he's referring back to the physical symbols. Christ was the creator. He was the Lord of the Old Testament. But yet it says he does provide spiritual nourishment and food that is needed by his people today. Every time Israel saw or thought of the manna, they were to remind themselves of God's great care, of his providing for their needs, of feeding them physically, of taking care of them. So what can we learn today from the manna? We can learn the very same lesson that the children of Israel did. The manna should remind us how much care God shows to us, how carefully he cares that he provides for us, how he fulfills our needs. Not necessarily our wants, but our needs. But you know, and it's more than just a physical level nowadays. It's on a spiritual level as well. Let's move ahead now and look at the next item in the ark, and that is Aaron's rod that budded. Now, this rod was very special. You know, I you dig out, you try to figure out, at least in my mind, how big was this rod? How long was this rod? And so in order to fit within the box, even if you did it diagonally, you have to see, roughly 5 feet. I'm guessing as much as that. It could have been shorter. Some of the commentaries will say it was like a shepherd's staff. And others will say, no, it wasn't. It was just a rod like they used to, like a walking stick. But, so the incident recording the rod budding is actually in the book of Numbers. And it was there to show people where God was working, to warn them not to rebel against him. And we'll look at that in some detail. We'll look at that incident here in a bit. But when you look into the various commentaries and they talk about Aaron's rod that budded, you'll notice, and we'll see as we read through these things, it was called various things. You'll see where it was called the rod of Moses. You'll see where it was called the rod of Aaron. You'll see where it was the rod of God or rod of the eternal. In all of these, it was talking about the exact same rod. Exodus 4. Let's look at some of those. Exodus 4, verses 2 through 4. Exodus 4, in verse 2. So the Lord said to him, talking to Moses, "What's in your hand?" He said, "A rod." And he said, "Cast it on the ground," and he cast it on the ground. It became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. I personally would have too. I hate snakes. You throw it in the ground, it turns into a snake. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Reach out your hand, take it by the tail." And he reached out his hand, and he caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. We see here it's called the rod of Moses, don't we? Let's quickly look at a few of these others. Verse 17 here of chapter 4 says, "You shall take this rod in your hand, which you shall do all the signs." So this rod was to be used to do signs, to perform signs. Verse 20, "And Moses took his wife and his sons, set them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand." Notice here, it's called the rod of God. And it's called that because of the miracles that were performed through God, through this rod. Chapter 7, verses 9 through 13. Verse 9 says, "When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, 'Show a miracle for yourselves,' you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your rod, cast it before Pharaoh, let it become a serpent.'" Remember, the rod had become a serpent in Moses' hand. Now we're going to look at it from Aaron's point of view. "So Moses and Aaron went to the Pharaoh, and they did so just as the Lord commanded. Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh, before his servants, and it became a serpent. But Pharaoh also called the wise men and sorcerers, and the magicians of Egypt. They also did in like manner with their enchantments. Every man threw down his rod, and it became a serpent. But Aaron's rod swallowed up all their rods, and Pharaoh's heart grew hard. He did not heed them, as the Lord had said." Notice here it's called Aaron's rod when he's in the court of Pharaoh. Miracles were done by it. In this case, it was with the serpent. And you can go through the chapters here. You can go through and see the different plagues as you go through there. And you will see again, very same rod. In various times, it's called Aaron's rod. Other times, it's called Moses' rod. Now, go to chapter 14 and verse 16 of Exodus. Exodus 14 and verse 16. "So the rod was used in all the plagues for Israel." Again, it kind of bounced back and forth between Moses and Aaron. Chapter 14, verse 16. It says, "I will lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it." So he's talking about the Red Sea. "The children of Israel shall go through on dry ground through the midst of the sea." So this is, again, the rod of Moses. He's got it. Now, we notice over and over again, The rod is the instrument, if you will, that's used to perform all these miracles of deliverance for protection of God's people. And we can go now, let's go then to chapter 17, verses 5 and 6. Again, the rod is being used. Exodus 17, verse 5. This is about water now. Verse 5, the Lord said to Moses, go before the people, take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hands your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you will strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. So we see again here, the rod is being used, this time to provide water in the desert. Verse 9, Moses said to Joshua, choose some men, go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So the same rod, but now it's the rod of God. Verse 11, so it was when Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. Again, this is that rod of God. Moses holds up the rod. Israel is winning. His arms get tired. He lowers the rod. The enemy begins to win. Again, this is a very physical representation of God's protection, his miraculous deliverance. He's performing a miracle right here again. Now, let's go to the passage that talks about the budding of the rod. We've established we have this rod, and it's called by these different names, and it's used to perform miracles. But in the book of Numbers, if you want to turn there, Numbers 17, and there had just been a rebellion against God and against God's leadership. If you remember, God took care of it in the most dramatic way. The earth opened up, swallowed all these people. And the very next day, you have all these people, they come before Moses and Aaron, and they accuse Moses and Aaron of killing some of the people. They blame them for what had happened. Even though the people that were killed were in absolute rebellion to God's way of life. Numbers 17, verses 1 through 5. The Lord said to Moses, speak to the children of Israel, and get from them a rod from each father's house, all their leaders, according to their father's houses, 12 rods. Write each man's name on his rod. And you shall write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi. So now this rod is called the rod of Levi. For there shall be one rod for the head of each father's house. You shall place them in the tabernacle of meeting before the testimony, before the Ten Commandments where I meet with you. And it shall be that the rod of the man whom I choose will blossom. Thus I will rid myself of the complaints of the children of Israel which were made against you. So you have these 12 rods from each of the 12 tribes, and they were put into the tabernacle. And God says, you know, the one that I select would be shown then to be the leader. He would show them through this rod where he was working, that there would be no doubt. Continue on, verse 7. Moses placed the rods before the Lord in the tabernacle of witness. It came to pass the next day, Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted, put forth buds, had produced blossoms, and yielded ripe almonds. And Moses brought out all the rods from before the Lord to all the children of Israel, and they looked, each man took his rod. This is not one of these situations where, you know, the decision could have gone either way. You know, maybe there's a bud, maybe there's not a bud. No, Aaron's rod had budded, produced flowers, produced ripe almonds. I mean, Moses comes dragging out an almond tree in effect here. God's very clear where he's working. There is absolutely no doubt. Verse 10 and 11. And the Lord said to Moses, bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put their complaints away from me, lest they die. And thus did Moses, just as the Lord had commanded him, so he did. So we see here the rod is to be kept with the testimony and the Ark of the Covenant. It's a reminder against rebellion. It was a sign. This is where the Eternal is working. So it was that sign to be placed in the ark to show where God was working. It was a warning then against rebellion. It's also a reminder of God's protection of his flock. Reminded them of all the miracles that had been performed, that rod had been used as that instrument. We need to have that same message drilled into us, I think. Need to remember all the wonderful works, all the miracles that God has done for us, both today, down throughout time, how he's preserved his church. God has the power to rescue, to protect his people from adversities, from trouble. What about the third item in the ark? Two tablets of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. We read back in Exodus 25, they were called the testimony. Two tablets of the Ten Commandments. They were placed in the ark. Now, we understand that the law of God, the Ten Commandments, is the basis for life. It is central to our covenant agreement with God, with all of his people down throughout time. And we know that the law sums up, it is a law of love. And it shows how God loves us. It shows how we are to love God. It shows how we are to have that outgoing concern, that love toward our neighbor. It gives us instructions for how to live successfully. Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6, verses 5 through 9. Deuteronomy 6, and in verse 5. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words that I command you today shall be in your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children. Talk of them when you sit in the house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontlet between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. It's showing us here that these laws were to be central to their lives, every aspect of their life. You know, you were to put them on the doorpost. You were to teach them to your children. Let's go down to verse 17. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, his testimonies and his statutes, which he's commanded you. You shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you, that you may go in and possess the good land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to cast out all the enemies from before you, as the Lord has spoken. And when your son asks you in the time to come, saying, what is the meaning of the testimonies, the statutes and judgments which the Lord our God has commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And the Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all of his household. And he brought us out from there, that he might bring us in to give us the land which he swore to our fathers. And the Lord commanded us to observe all the statutes, fear the Lord our God, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for you, if we are careful to observe all the commandments before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. So they were to pass this information along to each generation as they came along. So having these tablets in the ark were to remind the people, this is the very foundation, this is the very basis of a covenant relationship with God. It is vital. But equally important as the law was what it represented. It represented a covenant, an agreement with God. Notice, let's go to chapter, we're in Deuteronomy, chapter 29, verse 9. chapter 29 and verse 9. It says, therefore, keep the words of this covenant and do them that you may prosper in all that you do. Drop down to verse 12 and 13. That you may enter into covenant with the Lord your God and into his oath, which the Lord your God makes with you today, that he may establish you today as a people for himself, that he may be God to you, just as he has spoken to you, just as he has sworn to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Notice we are to enter, it says, into his covenant, into his agreement. But notice here it says also into his oath, into both of them, so that we can be established as his people. Now the covenant is the agreement. The oath that it's talking about is that ratification of that agreement by each party. You know, the agreement is one thing. That you agree to it is something else. He's incorporating both of those. When we're baptized, when we receive the Holy Spirit, we ratify the agreement, the new covenant, that agreement. We ratify that through our baptism, through the receiving of the Holy Spirit. We are then entering into God's oath and covenant. Shows us then that we are to be God's people. Let's go then to Judges now, the book of Judges 2, verse 1. Judges 2, just after the book of Joshua, but Judges 2, in verse 1. Judges 2, and the angel of the Lord came from Gilgal to Bochim, and said, I led you up from Egypt, brought you to the land which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you. It is not God who breaks the covenant, that relationship. They broke it. They didn't keep up their end of the agreement. But even then, he continued to work to reconcile them back to him, to, again, to try to restore that relationship that he had with them. It's the same with us. God is not going to leave the covenant relationship with us. We can leave it. You can be chastised. You can repent. You can come back. And he will then restore again that covenant relationship. Or you can leave and you can stay gone if you want. Forfeiting then that covenant relationship. You do pay a penalty for that, but what we see is God will never forsake us. He is faithful. Let's go to Jeremiah. Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 33. Jeremiah 31. This is a familiar section of Scripture, Jeremiah 31, 31. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in that day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says the Lord. This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel in those days, says the Lord. I will put my law in their minds. I will write it on their hearts. I will be their God. They shall be my people. A covenant. Here's another agreement in the future at this point in time. A covenant that God would make with his people. It has the same foundation. It's with his people again. He writes his laws. In other words, the terms of the covenant, that agreement on their hearts and in our minds. And as we keep this covenant, God will bless. He will preserve his people. Let's go to the next chapter, chapter 32, verse 40. Chapter 32, verse 40. God says, I will make an everlasting covenant with them, that I will not turn away from doing them good, but I will put fear in their hearts so that they will not depart from me. God says it's going to be an everlasting covenant, one that doesn't end. The word fear here means a proper respect, a proper reverence. Recall that when the old covenant was annulled, it was not because of God. It was because of the people. They couldn't keep up their end of it. So in this new covenant, people still need to have a proper respect, proper fear of God, so that they won't want to depart from Him. You've probably forgotten by now, but let's go back to our story that I started with at the beginning. After the man died, the box was located, and it was opened at the reading of the will. When it was opened, everybody was shocked, very disappointed. In the box were the following: the man's wife's wedding ring, a lock of her hair, baby pictures of each of his five children, a letter his wife had written to him telling how much she missed and needed him when he was working away from home at the time, their marriage license, and a few mementos. Nothing valuable, as anyone else would look at it, but it was invaluable to him because these items reminded him of his life, of his love, of his family. And in my box that I have here, it's much the same thing. For example, I have a $2 bill that my grandfather used to keep in his wallet so that he would always have money in his wallet. You know, it's probably from the 1930s. The thing is so fragile, it almost falls apart. I have pictures of friends in grade school. Some of these friends, I don't even remember their names anymore. I have a bowling score sheet from when I was a teenager. When I bowled 199, that's the highest I've ever bowled. I have that sheet of paper. I have a program for when our high school band went to Toronto, Canada. I have autographed pictures of four of the 1975 St. Louis Cardinals. I have a ticket stub from a symphony concert I attended. I have a program when I took my wife to her junior prom. There's a senior picture of, at the time, my best friend when we were growing up. You know, he's been dead now for longer than he was alive. The memories that are contained in this box. There's more, of course, but it would be worthless junk to most people, but not to me. Now, at first glance, the items in the Ark of the Covenant might seem also to be useless items as well. You see, they're extremely valuable to God. And so it should behoove us then to find out why. And that's what we've gone through today. We can now see why God chose the things that are in the Ark of the Covenant to be there. They were to remind His people throughout time of His constant presence. It was to remind them of His constant care and feeding them. And as His people considered these items, they remembered the miracles that were done in protecting them, delivering them. They were reminded of where He was working. They were reminded to be careful not to rebel against Him or His leadership. They were reminded that the tablets of the testimony showed God's love, and it showed them how to reciprocate that love to one another, to God. Perhaps most of all, they were reminded of God's mercy, that He would never leave them, that He would always be there. So today, we're able to come directly to the very mercy seat of God. We don't come before a physical box with objects in it to be a physical reminder. Hopefully, as we consider the Ark, we consider the things in it, we realize the very basis for all God's dealings with us. Just as He did for ancient Israel, He will feed us. He will nourish us with perfect spiritual food. He will supply all of our needs daily if we ask. He will rescue us. He will protect us. And above all, he will always be there for us. He will never leave us. He will never forsake us.